Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, welcome to episode 16 of A Small Voice. This is part two of a two-part interview with Harry Borden. So if you did miss part one last week, episode 15, then it may be a good idea for you to go and listen to that first before you enjoy this. Also, if you want to subscribe to this podcast, please go to iTunes and do so. And if you enjoy it, please leave a review on there. If you want to email me, then please do get in touch. A small voice at bensmithphoto.com. And just quickly before we start, to say that I think I may have lost a minute or two or more of this this chat, because during the interview my batteries ran out on my recorder, and being incredibly professional, I didn't have any replacements with me. So after several minutes of me and Harry unsuccessfully raiding someone else's remote controls for double A's that might work, we had to take a quick stroll to the corner shop. So in case it's a little unclear, the book that we're referring to about 12 minutes in is Harry's long-term project on Holocaust survivors, which you can see more of on his website, harryborden.com. And also you can read a brief explanation of the genesis for the project. Everything else, hopefully, is self-explanatory. So please do enjoy part two of Harry Borden.
But I was absolutely hopeless. And then, you know, I remember when I started to get jobs for the enemy, and I always had a lot of confidence, but you know, I was just not strategic. And there wasn't so much of a kind. There wasn't so much information out there about how you did it. I remember my friend, one of the other guys, you know, he'd started working for magazines, and he was going out with this girl. You know, we were all at a party, you know, and I remember sort of, you know, I had my portfolio in my car, and she worked for, I think she worked for Cosmopolitan or one of these magazines, and I sort of really wanted to get some works from, I wasn't working really for hardly any magazines, and I managed to persuade her in the middle of the party to come out into my car. And so she probably thought I was getting her out there for something else, but yeah. I managed to sort of persuade my friend's girlfriend to come out of the party, and we're in there in the dark, and I'm showing her my portfolio. You know, I was kind of very determined, but in a very imbecilic and incompetent way,
right?
And, and you know, and that's kind of, I've just sort of blundered into things. I've never had any strategy, basically. But you're right. I mean, I am a very competitive person, so you know, I just kept trying and doing my thing, and you know.
And also the fact that you had some confidence stood you in good stead. If you were getting sent by the enemy to photograph someone, you know, well known, you didn't ever feel like, well, yeah, I'm like, why are they sending me to do, you know, to do this?
I was very diligent. So so you know, for instance, I remember going to Manchester to photograph the Happy Mondays for a cover, you know, and the you know, after the shoot, you know, they were like, you know, the journalists, we all went, the idea was we were all going to go clubbing, you know, to the Hacienda and stuff, you know, and they were, everyone was popping pills and everything, and I was like, no, I need to go back to the hotel, you know. And the journalists had come in at like 9 o'clock the following morning looking completely wrecked and missed the train and everything, and I was sort of like, I was very, very diligent. I was never interested in working for the enemy, because I love music, but it wasn't for me about being a failed musician and therefore being a photographer. I wanted to add to my portfolio. They were getting me access to these people. I mean, it was very, like I was saying, there are things that happened. There was a guy called Justin Langlands there, and I don't know what's happened to him, but you know, I really love him, because you know, there are people along the way that for whatever reason just get behind you and like you, and I went in to see him, and you know, I had no pictures of any significance, just pictures of my friend shot on medium format, you know, from my Plymouth College of Art Design days. And you know, he got me straight, and I was a big fan of Steve Pike, and so my pictures were a bit like Steve Pike, and at that time Steve Pike was working for the NME, so I thought I'll go and see the NME, and they just immediately started giving me jobs. So I was like 20, and I was going to San Francisco, and or I was going to photograph Quentin Tarantino at the time of Reservoir Dogs, or you know, you know, Susanna Hoffs from the Bangles, you know, in her hotel room. You know, it was just, it was a really, I got off to a good start with the enemy, and it was all down to Justin Langlands. And it, quite often there are people that, if you can get someone who will, who really thinks you're good and will give you a good run, you know, you can build a whole career on that. And that happened to me at the Observer with Jenny Ricketts was the picture editor, but before her it was Nick Hall. And, you know, before then it was Victoria and Susan at the Independent. You probably worked for them.
Not those individuals, but yeah.
They were brilliant because they would, you know, I remember going to see the Sunday Times, and it was all big 80s male photographers like Clive Arrowsmith and, you know, these kind of big name photographers that they would use, John Swanell, actually. They wouldn't use anybody who was just starting out. Whereas Victoria Lukens and Susan Glenn, they take a punt on you and they give you these.
And I think a lot of us have had that experience of, you know, you go to some very major publications and someone for some reason will just become a sort of instant mentor. And I guess it sounds to me like that, and the guy that you mentioned at the NME, but also the, you know, Mr. Bookbinder.
Absolutely.
That was one of those kind of random, almost, you know, accidental.
Changed my life.
Changed the direction of everything.
Well, what happened was the Observer, Jenny was giving me work, and then I became Justine Picardy, who was the editor of the Observer Life at the time. She's now editor in chief of Harper's Bazaar. She just really loved me, and she just, I'd come in and she'd give me a hug, you know, which is I was just so scary and alien going into a newsroom. And she would just give me, she'd just be like, oh, the next job we've got for you is this. And actually, it probably alienated Jenny a bit because, you know, you should never lose, as a young photographer, never you lose sight of the people who actually commission you. You know, don't alienate them by going, you know, and sort of hanging out with the higher echelons of people who are one step removed from the picture desk, because the picture desk is the people who are kind of on the front line, you know. But, you know, as I said, there are these moments that happen that seem sort of, you know, maybe a lucky break or inconsequential at the time, like that Richard Branson shoot for American GQ.
Yeah, so that was one of the sort of inflection points, as it were.
Yeah, that was massive for me. And that was a massive turning point, because what happened was I remember sort of bumping into somebody, and, you know, he was a really good photographer. I can't remember his name, but I remember thinking, you know, I looked up to him when he started, and he said to me, or someone said to Abby, are you going out with Harry? You know, has he told you his secrets? And I think, you know, these sorts of, there aren't any secrets. They're just a whole series of steps, small steps, or just sowing seeds, just doing the right things, doing things kind of for the right reasons, having pure motivation, just being kind of trying to be true to yourself. So, like, getting back to that Richard Branson, you know, I did that shoot. By that stage, Cat's Pictures were syndicating my work, you know, and someone at Cat's Pictures said, you know, you should enter that picture. There's this thing called the World Press Photo. And I did remember the World Press Photo, because I remember I went to Tiverton Comprehensive, and we used to sit in the library, and they had these World Press Photos, and we'd look at these gory pictures because we wanted to see pictures of dead people.
Right.
And those images, I quite seared on my memory, but, you know, they would have been from the 70s. But I'd not really thought anything of the World Press Photo, and so he actually, back then, you know, it was all film, so he actually got made dupes of all my Richard Branson set, and he entered it. I didn't know what he was going on about. I mean, and at that point there'd never before been a portraits category in the World Press Photo, and he entered it in there, and then I remember Steve Blogg, who was working at the time for Cat's Pictures, phoned me up, and he said, I've got some amazing news. You've won a prize in the portraits category of the World Press Photo. And I said to him, so do I get any money? And he said, no, but lots of photographers spend their whole life.
So you didn't even really know that it was a big deal?
No, I didn't. And then it was explained to me that because I hadn't come first in that category, that they wouldn't pay for me to go to the Amsterdam and, you know, give a talk or anything like that. But you should go anyway. And I was like, I think my daughter had just been born, and I just thought, well, you know, I was getting in loads of... That's the other thing, is that you go through these phases where you're really hot and lots of good things happen and you're winning. You can't stop winning things. And then enjoy it, because nothing lasts. Mm. The universal law of impermanence, everything changes, you know. So just embrace it and be in the moment and be happy. Don't try and think it's going to last.
You know, that thing of kind of treating both those imposters the same, you know, that you know, there are kind of triumphs and disasters, and you've got to play
absolutely.
The long game, really. And,
absolutely.
And, yeah.
So then I didn't go to the World Press photo. I didn't even go to the Pride. They sent the trophy in the post. And then, like, a year later, I photographed Björk for The Observer. Mm. And by then I thought, well, I'll enter it again. And then I got like second prize in the portraits category again. And I didn't go again. And it was only when, you know, like in 2011, when I was judging it and they asked me to judge it and I sort of went, I realized what an absolute clown I was, you know. What an absolute idiot. Because you're basically given opportunity to talk to the world's media about your work. You know, it would have, you know, it was so stupid.
But, you know, we're all, yeah, we've all got stories of just being dumb as fuck when we're that age, and you just, there's so much you don't realize. And then you realize that actually, like you say, the guy at Katz who entered for you, there are all these people working away in the background to actually help you. And you just, so I'm always thinking that, you know, people, young people these days are so much smarter and more on
absolutely,
it and,
yeah.
and don't have that level of naivety that we had about things. And
I remember going when I first came up to London, going into news agents and, you know, in a fit of excitement, sort of looking at all these magazines and sort of looking at the credits and thinking that each credit represented a potential job that you could get.
Right.
You know? And I, apropos of time, I remember thinking, there's nothing to stop you getting up at, like, you know, 6, 5 o'clock in the morning every day and just sort of, if you methodically, you know, go through, you know, you're constantly arranging go-sees and going to go-sees. Mm. And then, you know, I mean, what I did was when I was working at the NME, again, sort of slightly amateurish and mad, you know, I'd go into the NME when it was published because I wanted to work for the Independent on Sunday Review. And I'd get a bundle of NMEs, you know, like 25 NMEs. And I'd take them back to my flat and I'd sort of cut out the tear sheets, and then I'd post them to Victoria Lukens, and I'd say, I remember the same letter, I'd say, you know, how are you? I hope you're well. Just thought you might be interested in knowing what I've been up to.
Yeah.
But so eventually it becomes embarrassing for them not to give you a job.
Yeah.
You know?
So you did have that persistent sort of side to things and that determination.
Yeah, but it was just before, and I guess actually sending something, a hard copy, or actually the physical manifestation of a tear sheet rather than a sort of a PDF, it's harder to ignore. It's more embarrassing when you bump into them for them to not have had given you a job.
Yeah, and also that, you know, to some extent you're being rewarded for that persistence. I mean, everyone recognises that as a desirable trait, right? So, you know.
Well, Alex Ferguson said, you know, that what people don't realise is working hard is a talent as well. You
exactly.
know, and that's why United... I talk about Man United. It's, you know, but for me, the perfect match of the day was always Man United losing, Roy Keane getting sent off. You know?
Right.
And in spite of the fact I shot him for his autobiography and I've shot Beckham and everything, I sort of still have an insane desire to see them fail.
Right.
But although I really admire the man, and he does talk a lot of sense, and actually the kind of ethos that team had applies to anything, and it's about persistence and hard work. You know, and you do, it's necessary given that you've got the talent, you know, but a lot of people have got talent, you know, you have to apply that and be consistent in your kind of belief in yourself and, you know, very workaday about it.
Yeah. So we were talking about your book project. Is it quite a long gestation period for it to not be out until 2017? Is there a reason for that behind that?
Getting embroiled in daytime television, or the, you know, it's the summer, Wimbledon. You know, I make it seem like I'm really lazy, but I am quite lazy, and also I did have a few, you know, I do think it's actually benefited from a longer gestation period, because for instance the cover is a sort of a blurry picture that I don't even remember taking that well, and certainly was never intended to be included in the in the actual project. And then these things sort of, you know, they into your subconscious, you know, these things sort of bubble up. And I happened to sort of be looking at the folders of the pictures, and I found this blurred picture that I'd taken just for the joy of it and everything. And then over the course of a day or so, I sort of realized that it would make a really good cover, you know, and that happened sort of several years after I took the picture, you know, and I'd forgotten taking it, you know, and the actual form of the book and, you know, I think you can rush, you know, and actually good things happen if you stop thinking about something. And maybe, you know, and maybe it's a symptom of ADHD, but I kind of, you know, tend to get distracted and then go on to something else, and then while I'm doing that, and then I'm sort of subconsciously thinking about the original thing, and then something more interesting will bubble up to my conscious mind and be pertinent and usable, you know, like that image that made a very enigmatic and interesting cover.
But have you, as far as you're concerned, finished shooting?
Yeah, I think so, because I've got an offer, you know, it's contractually all happening on the, you know, spring 2017. I feel like I've shot almost 200 portraits, and they're looking at 108 spreads. So that means there's a significant number of people who I effectively wasted their time. You know, it wasn't a waste of their time, but, you know, it's sort of sad if you photograph somebody and they're not going to be in the final edit. So I think it's important to sort of draw a veil and, you know, then move on to the next thing.
But so it's sort of almost a year and a half from finishing to actual publication.
And I've been working on it for about 8 years.
But really
the actual time that I've spent shooting has been quite condensed, you know, like I shot three people in a day on occasion. Definitely when I went to Australia and Israel, you know, I had a schedule to meet, you know, because it was all self-funded. I did get a little grant from the John Cabal Foundation, but apart from that, the whole thing, you know, was just paid for by me.
Yeah. And how come there hasn't been a book of, you know, celebrity portraits? Is that on the cards, or is there a reason why there hasn't?
I always felt that you know, that can be something that can be left to my dotage. You know, I sort of hopefully at 60 or 70, you can have a sort of grand retrospective at the National Portrait Gallery in a book that accompanies that. But, you know, I think quite often as well, you don't appreciate which pictures are the really interesting ones, you know, with regard to, say, for instance, that Michael Hutchins picture. It was only after he died, 2 years after I took the picture, that the picture that sort of ended up being the most memorable one sort of surfaced. And quite often, you know, you might include pictures that you like at the time because they were more difficult to achieve, whereas some pictures that just drop in your lap, you might be sort of dismissive of.
Well, as you said before, though, you'd missed that picture in a way. It was your printer who pulled that one out. And the magazine had missed it as well because they used different ones.
And what I've also been doing is a series of just written memoirs of the actual shoots. So I am kind of intending to publish that at some stage, but I'd like to you know, maybe work with a writer. I've been working with a writer in The Amateur Photographer, doing a series called When Harry Met, which is sort of in part kind of insight into the photographic aspects, but also into the sort of aspects, strange as they are, of meeting these people who are kind of odd, you know.
Yeah, what are the ones that really, you know, stick in your memory? Has anyone been completely obnoxious?
Well, people always ask me that, and yes, for instance, Isabella Blow, the now deceased fashion sort of stylist sort of icon, was, you know, monumentally rude and difficult to photograph. I mean, that was quite an extraordinary story. It was for The Observer. We went round to her house, and the whole thing started badly because she'd been sort of saying that she was too busy to be photographed, and then she'd kind of reluctantly agreed So we turned up on Monday morning, and it turned out that, you know, she hadn't been busy at all. She'd just been sort of partying throughout the whole weekend. And I went through the usual kind of process of showing her my portfolio. And, you know, instead of, you know, even pretending that she liked the pictures, as some people who aren't maybe visually literate or maybe just don't like the pictures would do, she sort of just looked around at other people to sort of see what opinion she should have, you know. And as an arbiter of fashion, you'd think she'd be kind of, she'd have an instinct for these things, but she was kind of dismissive. And then she introduced me to this guy who's a photographer. She introduced him as her publicist, and he was so kind of difficult. I think I began to realize that he'd wanted to do the shoot, and he'd been staying with her. Maybe he was her lover, and he was sort of going to wreak his kind of revenge on me. And so initially we sort of sat around and we were drinking coffee, and she and he were just sort of discussing the weekend that had just happened. And he was sort of my age, you know, and he'd been sort of going on about how he'd been sort of sleeping with these models, and they were kind of like, they were my daughter's age. And I sort of took kind of exception to him as a, you know, he was just an awful kind of, he's like something out of Zoolander. He was sort of wearing a Philip Tracy sort of peak cap, sort of a wife beater, I believe, you know, sort of sleeveless, and then sort of cut off tracksuit bottoms with no pants, sort of leaving very little to the imagination. And his name was Donald McPherson. I'm going to name him.
You're actually going to out him.
I think his name is Donald McPherson, but he was just really awful. And he tried to make it as difficult as he could for me to actually do my job. And so I sort of acquiesced and just went along with it. And I remember sort of walking around her house looking for locations. Each one in turn he would veto for various sort of aesthetic reasons, even though he wasn't, it was explained to me that he wasn't a photographer, he was her publicist. And eventually I sort of went into her bedroom, and he was sitting in there with his assistant smoking a joint. And I began to sort of suspect that he might be a photographer or be involved in photography. And I said, so are you a photographer? And he sort of looked at his assistant and sniggered, and he said, well, you could say that. And so I said to him, oh really? And he said, you know the portfolio that you showed Isabella downstairs, you know, the portfolio of your work, you know, with all those famous people in it. And I said, yes. And he said, well, I photographed all those people, but for me, they're not my subjects. They're my friends. And I should have just punched him on the nose and just walked out. But I kind of, it was just such a kind of humiliating experience.
Yeah. And also, he wasn't even the subject. He was just some kind of addendum.
I looked him up after. He's just some kind of journeyman fashion photographer, some hanger on who's still sort of dining out on the fact that he once knew Isabella Blow. And so basically,
and she's not even that famous anyway.
She was horrible. She was like this vampiric figure, sort of, who kind of feasted on the talent of other people around her and sort of aggrandized herself by sort of association. So basically I did the shoot. You know, we ended up, the only place he would let me shoot her was in the bathroom, and I just shot it with a ring flash. I just thought, it's like a photo me booth. I got perfectly good pictures because she has amazing hats and she's quite unusual looking. And I sort of felt thoroughly humiliated and soiled by the whole kind of process. And I walked out the front door, having packed up all our equipment into the car and everything, and the door was shut. And then I just sort of finally got a little bit of backbone. And while we'd been sort of setting up in the bathroom, this guy had come in, and he'd sort of just basically, in the middle of us setting up, he just sort of, you know, urinated into the toilet. And, you know, I got the impression he was definitely staying there. So an idea popped into my head. So I knocked on the door and I said, before I go, can I just use your bathroom? And I went into the bathroom and I got all the toothbrushes and I sort of pushed them and cleaned the toilet with them, put them down the toilet. And then I just sort of felt I'd salvaged some dignity.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I don't think anyone died of any kind of
terrible disease.
Terrible disease. But that was by far and away the most memorably horrible shoot. And I said to the fashion editor, because I gave her a lift back to Hackney after the shoot, I said, wasn't she horrible? You know, you can tell them about me putting the toothbrushes down the toilets. I would never do that. You know, that I was sort of pushed so hard that I thought, you know, that they could write about that in the piece. You know, Lynn Barber would have done. And the piece came out and she didn't even mention any of it, because she was obviously aware of the fact that Isabella Blow had a lot of clout. But most of the time, I didn't mean to tell that whole story, but most of the time, you know, people are, you know, you're part of the process that makes them famous. And so people are quite happy to kind of go along and be...
In your experience, is there any sort of, broadly speaking, truth to the whole, the bigger the star, the nicer they are kind of, you know, cliche? Is that...
There's an element of truth to that, definitely. And certainly, you know, I remember photographing Nicole Cook, because I've done a whole series, this will be another project, for the Observer Sport. I did a whole series called The Contender, and they were all young kids, basically, who people within their sport had tipped as future stars. And I went to Swansea, or outside of Swansea, to photograph Nicole Cook, who ended up being women's world cycling champion. And she was such a sweetheart. And you know, she was just a kid. And my assistant, Annie, I think at the time, said, oh, you know, I was printing out a picture of it for my portfolio. And Annie said, oh, you should send her a picture. And very unlike me, because as a photographer, you're constantly like a shark moving on to the next thing. I mean, I've often thought that actually it would be a really good move to print out a picture of everybody I photograph and send it to their agent or whatever. I sent her this picture, and I got like a big long letter back about her hopes for the future and the tournaments that she was going to be taking part in. So, she was somebody who, you know, was actually not a prima donna, in spite of the fact that she was just starting out. But I think, by and large, people have sort of, you know, it's just about insecurity. And, you know, I think if you can assure people that you're not going to misrepresent them and that you're good at what you do, even the ones that don't suffer fools can be won over. You know, I think Isabella Blow was an exception. Most of the time, it's a joyous thing. I mean, you're meeting people that are at a good time in their lives quite often, and you're just recording the interaction you have with them, and it's fun.
And there's a sort of professionalism to most of these people. Most people are very sweet, and like you say, at the very worst, they're going to just have a sort of no messing kind of attitude. But that's just kind of another aspect of their professionalism in a way. What about Robin Williams? Tell me about that one. There's a picture you've got. He's got his hand over his face.
Yeah, well, that was part. I was saying that was one I wrote about just off my own bat, under the hashtag When Harry Met. And you know, that was just a kind of, you know, that I really, there was no kind of method. It wasn't kind of exceptionally unusual, that shoot. It was pretty typical of the shoots I did. The reason I wrote about it, I think, was because the reason I put it up there was because of him having died recently. But I mean, it was just.
But didn't you have to get on a plane just to go and do that?
Absolutely. I mean, it was memorable in that sense. It was just the basic fact that I was over in New York, and I'd been working over there. I'd just been seeing magazines. Not like I go to New York all the time. I just happened to go and see a tranche of magazines there and with my portfolio. And I got a call from my agency, and they said, you've got the opportunity to do Robin Williams. So I was really excited about that. And they said I'd have half an hour, and then so I changed my ticket, arrived in London, you know, on the red eye to the with the journalist, and was told that, you know, we might not have time for any pictures. We've got half an hour for the interview and the pictures. So
but was it an awareness that kind of shooting people like him was going to just be good for your career that made you get on a plane and go
the way? Absolutely.
You knew straight away that you know, it was worth
I have this a tenacity. A better example is my first ever shoot for the NME was this guy called Craig Gannon, who was the guitarist with the Smiths briefly. And I was a massive Smiths fan, but in any case, he wasn't that well known. But it was an opportunity, and I used to use a Rolleiflex twin lens reflex then, and I had some Nikons as well. And so we went up to Manchester to photograph him. And we saw him perform. So I did some live pictures. And then the next day we met in this gallery and I did some sort of very black and white, sort of very simple, stark pictures. And someone had fiddled with the Rolleiflex and put it onto B. And so my flash hadn't synced properly with the camera. So none of the medium format camera stuff would come out. So we sort of, I returned to London. I was all happy. My first commission for The Enemy. I didn't have a dark room and I wanted to control the processing myself and print it all myself. So I drove from London down to the Devon where my parents live, you know, 200 miles, and basically stayed up all night developing the films, and then realized to my horror that the pictures on the Rolleiflex hadn't come up. And for some reason, I sort of made a connection with Craig Gannon, and he was kind enough that he'd given me his number and, you know, said, meet up if you're in, come up here again. And so I phoned him up. I didn't tell The Enemy this. And I basically drove to Taunton and then took the train up to Manchester, which back then was about 5 hours. And then reshot the stuff on the Rolleiflex and then took the train 5 hours back, by which time The Enemy really needed the pictures and I had slept the previous night, and then, you know, processed them all, and then drove straight to King's Reach Tower, IPC Magazines, where The Enemy was based, and sort of delivered the pictures. And they did run the Rolleiflex, but it was almost like I made a mistake and I wanted to punish myself. I wanted to sort of, I didn't want there to be any chance of me not showing them how good I was, you know. So
yeah, and you realised that there was a way of at least, you know, kind of rectifying the mistake.
So my assistant, Annie, you know, she's not like me. I mean, I remember her doing this job and she phoned me up and she said, she had a medium format camera and she was photographing somebody in the King's Road or something in London. And she said, the camera's broken. You know, I've had to cancel the shoot and everything. And I said to her, you know, that's not the end of it. There's always a way around these things. I mean, that was telling you about that thing with Father Ted, you know, when I didn't actually bring any cameras with me and then the lights blew up, you know. You can just go into a camera shop and buy a camera. You could you could get a disposable camera, you know. It's good enough for Jürgen Teller, you know, to use a snapshot camera. You can get an arresting picture, you know. There's always a solution, you know.
Yeah, you just have to, but you have to have a certain kind of.
I think it's innate in my personality. I mean, when I play,
some people would just fucking panic and just, you know, kind of lose it. And I guess, you know, you're not like that. You've got a slightly calmer.
Yeah, well,
approach.
Peter Dench came and played me at tennis. You know, he's doing an interview for his Hungry Eye magazine, and he spent a day or so with me in Devon, and I read the article and it makes a big play of the fact that I'm very competitive, but it's a sort of a tenacity, and I do play tennis and golf and stuff like that, and I think my friends would say in as well as being quite competitive, I'm just mentally, I'm just not the type of person who knows when they're beaten, so I will kind of, you know, I will never give up, you know. So there's always, you know, there is always a way around it. I mean, there's another shoot I did. I remember shooting Kanye West, and you're always going to get disappointments. So you shrug your shoulders and you get lemons and you make lemonade. And that's, I'm quite a positive person, I think. So with Kanye West, he'd just been to Louis Vuitton and he'd been given this bag, and he was wearing a duffel coat, a purple scarf and shades. And he was holding this Louis Vuitton bag. And I'd been promised that we had a stylist and we had two changes of clothing and we had half an hour. And he just said, I'm not going to get changed. I'm not taking off my sunglasses. And I'm going to be holding this bag in all the pictures, because obviously he promised them that they would give them some publicity.
Oh, my God.
So I just, in that sort of situation, initially I tried to sort of use my powers of persuasion. And then you realize that he's a kind of lunatic and probably a bit of a megalomaniac, and so you just go with it. And so I just thought to myself, what does he look like? He looks like, I've got to photograph him like that. What does he look like? He looks like he's on his way to the shoot or is on his way from the shoot. So I sort of found a goods lift, you know, and, you know, I had a backdrop all set up and everything, and I just took him out away from the studio I'd made in the suite and put him in the goods lift and had shot him in the lift as though he was sort of arriving, and it worked as a picture, you know. And so quite often there's always kind of ways of, you know, finessing something out of a you know, a situation that seems on the surface kind of hopeless.
You mentioned a couple of other book projects are in the pipeline. What are those, if you're prepared to reveal?
Yeah, well, I'd like to shoot more single parent fathers.
Okay, so that's another project that you've been working on a while. Yeah, just explain what that's about a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, my kind of observation. I mean, as I said previously, I try and sort of think, well, how do I feel about this? You know, there are certain subjects. I think it was Phil Toledano on Facebook said that, you know, or he maybe was quoting someone else, but he sort of observed that, nudity is a good sort of substitute for a good idea kind of thing. And there are certain subjects that people can do, you know, and Dan Arbus was very good at doing them, you know, freaks and transsexuals and hermaphrodites and circuses. Mary Ellen Mark was very good at doing them as well, and you know, and you're halfway to getting a good picture. But for me, I've just tried to do, in my personal projects, I just try and think about how I personally feel about these subjects. So, you know, sort of middle-aged single parent dads is actually quite difficult. It's difficult photographing children anyway, and it's difficult. They're not sort of innately photogenic or heartwarming necessarily. But I'm a father, you know, and I think fatherhood is sort of much maligned in society, especially. And these guys are very isolated and don't, you know, have much of a support network often, because they're kind of slightly, they can be ostracized by mothers' groups, and because women sadly tend to be the main carer, you know. I mean, I think one thing that's happened in society, in our society, which is sad, is that sort of... And I sort of would regard myself as a feminist, but feminism is sort of taken to mean women working as hard in such a lunatic way as men, whereas feminism should be really, as in Denmark and places like that, about men doing their fair share of domestic chores, and especially sort of parenting, because for the benefits, it's much better for the children. And so I just sort of thought I'd do a project on single parent dads, and it was very fortuitous. What happened was someone from a charity called Dad's House, Natasha, phoned me up, contacted the Royal Photographic Society, because they knew I was in some exhibition at the Royal Photographic Society, and asked if I'd be willing to give away a portrait session with a single parent dad in order to raise awareness for their charity. And so I contacted her and I said, actually, you know, I've been thinking about fatherhood and I'd like to do a series of portraits of single parent dads, but they're quite difficult to get to agree to be photographed, because quite often their relationships that have broken down with the mother of their children are quite sort of fragile, and they don't want to be seen to be putting themselves on a pedestal. They're often quiet men who are just sort of stoically getting on with the job of bringing up their kids. And through that, I've ended up doing other types of single parent dads. Like The Guardian saw the project, The Guardian Weekend, and they commissioned me to do a gay single parent dad, a guy who'd basically wanted to be a father to the extent that he finished his relationship and then sold his business and paid a surrogate so he could have a baby. Mm. You know, so basically it's just a celebration of fatherhood. And it's also about, you know, it's not about fathers for justice kind of, it's more about, you know, just what's in the best interest of the children, you know. And so these men are quietly, they're not politically, the project's not political or angry. Mm. It's more conciliatory and more about relationships and about the most important people in the advent of a breakdown being the children.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it's been again a very rewarding experience, and you know, it's funny how the celebrity portraits feed into that, because I photographed Bob Geldof for the Guardian Weekend. He did an interview, the first interview after his daughter had died, and I was sort of chatting to him about the fact that the last time I'd been at this particular studio, I'd been doing Baroness Thatcher, and I thought he was joking initially, but he said that he was actually really good friends with Thatcher.
Right.
And she used to ring him up in the middle of the night, and he'd go round and talk to her, which is kind of quite strange when you think about it, because they both lived in sort of southwest London. And he asked if he could have a print of Baroness Thatcher. You know, I showed him the single parent dads, which he liked. And he asked, strangely enough, to have a print of Tony Blair and Cameron, and I think he just wanted to have a little gallery in his house. So I sent him some prints, and then I realised that I'd actually photographed Peaches. I'd actually forgotten, so I sent him an edit of the pictures of Peaches, and he emailed me and sort of thanked me, and really, really poignant email, sort of saying that you know, that's all he has is things like that, and said thanks, and offered to help with the single parent dad's project. So I've asked him to write an essay on fatherhood, and it turned out he was brought up by a single parent dad. I didn't realize that. He's written me this essay that obviously I've not published it yet because it's going to be part of the book, but the most extraordinary, passionate, articulate, angry essay on fatherhood. So it's amazing how these things, fortuitous things, happen if you're open to the possibility, you know. And it came from me trying, just doing a good thing, you know, exactly, sending him some prints. I wasn't sort of cynically thinking I was sort of cycling along and I was thinking, well, actually he's quite an advocate for fatherhood. I could get him to maybe write something.
Yeah. He's almost the perfect person. Exactly. Well, even before you know that he was brought up by.
It's the same with the Holocaust survivors. You know, I photographed Howard Jacobson for the Sunday Times, and so I sent him a copy, the dummy that I'd made for the European Publishing Award for photography. I sent him a copy, and and he said he thought it was a really noble project. And I said, email me back. And so I said, could you write an introductory essay? You know, and he's a Booker Prize winning author. Yeah. So it's very articulate, so I think it's perfect for that.
Yeah. So. Do people often ask for prints, though? I mean, or you know, do you get much feedback from your subjects as to whether they like the image or that they saw the image? Or
I try not to ever shoot for them, so you know, I take it for granted that you know that I just try to be true to myself. Quite often, you get positive feedback in a more general way, like from the magazine, because you're working for the magazine, you've got a working relationship with them, and you hear back that they like the piece, and that probably includes the photography. But yeah, I mean, people are off, they don't expect you to give them prints, and they're often delighted when you do. I mean, I photographed just recently, I don't know whether it's embargoed actually, or whether I should mention it, but basically I photographed, by the time this comes out, maybe Tom Daly and his fiancée.
Right.
I photographed him for a magazine, and I'd photographed Tom when he was 13 with his family down in Plymouth for the Observer Sport Monthly.
And I should probably clarify, Tom Daly's an Olympic diver.
Yeah, that's right.
And
the nation's sweetheart.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's our children's generation. My kids are, you know, he's got 2.5 million followers on Twitter, and his fiance is wrote the screenplay for Milk, so he's an Oscar-winning screenwriter. So they're kind of like big deal, and especially in America now. But yeah, I photographed him, and so I brought along some prints of his family, because I'd done a whole family group, you know, with his dad, who'd happened to have died subsequently of a brain tumor, I think. And so you know, it was really lovely to be able to do that. But you know, I mean, people don't expect it in answer to your question, but when you do give them prints, they're usually delighted.
I appreciate it, yeah.
Although, having said that, and I always thought this said something about the enigma that is Tony Blair, possibly slightly sociopath, was I photographed Tony Blair about 4 times. One of the pictures I think got in I think it was called the Schweppes then, before the Taylor Wessing, and it got in the exhibition. And so I got the print back, you know, and then I got to photograph him again. So I thought, I'll bring along the print and give it to him. And he's got this amazing sort of shtick, Tony Blair, you know, like he's a leader of men and everything. And it's kind of this sort of act that is very impressive. And then I was reading The Psychopath Test by John Ronson, you know, and it's all kind of, people learn that kind of human interaction, but they can't be spontaneous because they don't sort of have any empathy. And I sort of, I'm not saying that Tony Blair's a psychopath, but it was quite strange and quite telling that I suddenly sort of produced this print, huge print, because it was in the Schweppes, you know, and gave it to him, you know, like 2016-inch print. And he was completely wrong-footed. He didn't really know...
Didn't know how to react.
You know, he could have just been gracious and said, oh, thanks for the print. It was quite a weird picture, but you know, it was you know, it got in an exhibition, so it wasn't a technically bad picture or anything like that. Maybe it was the size, but it kind of, I guess he wasn't expecting.
He was
off the usual kind of interaction that he's expected to have on a day-to-day basis with kind of the media.
I was going to ask you, you mentioned the Tom Daley thing. That some of the shoots you do are sort of these big production numbers now, and despite the fact that clearly you'd prefer it if it was the opposite of that, well, kind of give me a sort of sense of what some of them are like when they're very involved. I just wonder, you know, if people would be interested in the sort of anatomy of a shoot like that, even including the kind of build-up to it and the pre-production and all that.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, that was kind of very... It's very stressful because you have, you know, can you find a... It's for an American magazine, so the people involved in putting it together, you know, they have a good budget, but, for instance, they are thinking, well, where can we shoot it? And Tom Daley says, or his people say, you know, he's in London Bridge. So you have to find somewhere around London Bridge to start with, which is quite difficult. You know, the budget's not too bad, so that's not necessarily too much of an issue. And then you have to hire a stylist, and the stylist has an assistant. And the stylist can sort of actually... The stylist I used for that shoot is a guy called David Bradshaw, who's a friend of mine, a neighbour in Hackney, who's very, very highly regarded in the world of fashion. So that really helped actually elevate the shoot and had a lot of good contacts. So they'd be responsible for drawing in all the clothing and so on. And then you have someone who's doing the grooming, possibly a hair, separate hair and makeup. But I had Juliana Sergo, who works for me, and she did both. And then, you know, assistants. I'd rather sort of be lifting the cases out of the car myself than have loads of assistants. And, you know, I know that people like Steven Meisel, you know, high-end fashion photographers, they have one assistant who they talk to, and then the other assistants don't talk to them. So, you know, it's like a hierarchy. Whereas I don't like that. I like my assistants. If I'm sort of chatting to my subject, my assistant, because I very rarely... I mean, I might have an assistant and then somebody else who's coming along doing a bit of experience from college, you know, work experience and so on. But I tend to like assistants who are familiar with my work and would like the idea of seeing how I do things. I'm not interested in using professional assistants. I mean, I have occasionally used professional assistants when it's difficult lighting situations and you're doing an advertising shoot, which is much more about the technique. But by and large, you have a team of people there. It's a collaborative process. It's more like, you know, a film, really. So, but, you know, actually, you know, I say I like the quick shoot. If you do have that kind of resources and you have all day and you have a lot of time with someone, you can get extraordinary results. You know, it doesn't have to be stultifying. It doesn't have to be the sort of death of creativity. You can kind of, if you can keep things loose, and as I tried to with, you know, that's why I brought along the prints with of Tom's family. You know, you can make it an authentic and an enjoyable experience for them, you know. But if you're not careful, it can be... You know, I mean, what I like to do is when people arrive or having grooming, I mean, so many times you get people who turn up and they're incredibly stylish people, and then they go through this process and they look less stylish or
then
less
they started out
when they started. Yeah.
The only thing I haven't really got into, which I was interested in, was you know, the way that you talking about your dad not being particularly supportive, and I'm interested in where you got your sense of kind of self from, in a way, you know. You know, how come he wasn't, as a sort of ad man, that he did, you know, he clearly
you know, I'm not going to sort of like be, you know, my dad didn't love me, boo hoo.
No.
I mean, I think basically but for whatever reason, you know, my dad's sort of quite a hard, I mean, I don't think it was like you know, he was sort of kidding me into trying really hard by sort of, you know, he's just for his own reasons, he was just very dismissive of the idea of me becoming a photographer. You know, my dad said, you know, my dad worked, you know, commissioned like Andy Warhol or Irving Penn. He worked with these people, And, you know, I think probably his sort of self-esteem is sort of built up as in his ego as being kind of a big ad guy. And I think, so he did have probably very, very high standards. But, you know, I think part of growing up, part of becoming an adult is actually sort of putting your parents in a box and seeking to sort of seek their approval. So, you know, I could say, you know, I remember my dad very clearly, you know, I said I wanted to be a photographer. My dad said, I've worked with photographers. You haven't got what it takes to become a photographer. Work in a camera shop. And my sister, who is Frances, who's, you know, won £10,000 in the NatWest Prize. You know, she's very good at art.
She's a painter.
You know, he said to her, you haven't got what it takes to become a painter. You know, do window dressing. But, and my brother, who's went to the Royal College of Art and is a painter also, and is doing very well at the moment, actually, he said about him, you know, join the army. So, you know, he's got a track record of being wrong and
you've all managed
wrong.
You've all managed to transcend that kind of his determination to sort of kind of somehow, you know, not let you get above yourselves or whatever. And you've actually gone out and proved it. Well, maybe it's a kind of weird kind of, you know, kind of, you know, inverse psychology. He was trying to...
Yeah, I know. I don't think it was. I just think a big part of your kind of tenacity and your confidence is so sort of innate because, you know, I think that's why people, I mean, I kind of am, you know, my principles would dictate that I would prefer there not to be private schools, you know, state schools are sort of better. But one of the reasons people might say that private schools are better is because they sort of make these people more confident. But quite often you see these people who, and I don't want to sort of seem like I'm a class warrior or anything like that, but these people who are insanely confident and they run into the brick wall of their kind of lack of talent, you know. And ultimately, you know, I didn't need any encouragement. I just sort of, what I try and do, my sort of own personal, I think my sister's the same and actually my brother too. And I think this applies to anyone. This is a really good thing to tell people, which is do things for the intrinsic pleasure of doing them, to just play, just be creative. Don't do them because, you know, for other people's approval, your parents or anybody else. And, you know, my sister initially, you know, she was always good at art and stuff. But, you know, he never gave us any approval. But it meant that she did it for the right reasons. She was just playing and she's, you know, she does it now. My brother's the same. My brother just goes out in the streets of London and paints just for the pleasure of it. Mm. And, you know, that's what I do is I just try and enjoy myself. I try and be playful and then time just flows. And actually what happens is that whether you're successful or not, you end up having a nice life because you've spent it doing something that you get intrinsic pleasure from rather than goal driven. And, you know, if you go for the... You're only going to there's always going to be another goal on the horizon that, you know, that will, you know, there'll always be someone better than you or more famous than you. So it's better just to enjoy, and it sounds like such a cliche, but be in the moment and enjoy the intrinsic pleasure of photography because it's so absorbing and it's never been more interesting than it is at the current time.
Mm. Well, I don't know if it's a cliche, but I think it's always worth saying it anyway.
Mm.
I think we'll end it there, Harry. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
It's been a great joy to talk to you.
Well, I've got to say, it would be hypocritical of me not to be involved because I've really enjoyed your work and, you know, you're building something, you know, very interesting, you know, it's a document of contemporary photography and it's a valuable resource.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate that. That's great.